Let's start with this role that you're seeing at the Met. When I got the information about this interview, I was sent your bio, I was sent the information about the production, and I was also sent the New York Times Review. And I read the New York Times Review thinking that I was reading the press release, and I thought, this is a little over the top for a press release, you know? They shouldn't be so emphatically positive about this performance. I mean, for goodness sake.
Where's their modesty?
Well, yeah, my first question is, do you read your reviews? And having had such a phenomenal review as this, does it make it difficult to live up to it every time you perform the role?
Ah, okay. Now, this is a big question because it actually gets a bit philosophical. But yes, I do read my reviews. I learned early on whether they're good or bad, how to take them in context and not attach to them. One of the first big things I did as a student, I got my mother could have written the review. It was over the top. It was crazy. And there was something about it. This is probably my Irish modesty, you know, this Catholic Midwest modesty. But I remember thinking, you know, if I sort of buy into this, when the really bad reviews come along, I'm going to have to buy into those as well.
Live by the pen, die by the pen.
Yeah. And so I said, you know what? I'll use them when they're good. When they're bad, I'll see if there's something I can learn from it. But I'm not going to ever make a review sort of the gospel truth because they're always subjective. And that same reviewer could come to a different performance, a different night, and have a very different reaction. So I try very hard to make sure I'm taking them in context. But you know, they do serve a purpose, especially what I think Mr. Tomasini's review did was it wasn't just about, oh, the staging was this and the singing was that. I think he captured what I felt on the stage was the mood of the house. This was a gala audience. Sometimes these audiences are not necessarily here for deep art. Sometimes they're here for an experience and the party.
No, you're being too modest now. Because they had the champagne afterwards, remember?
Right. Well, those can sometimes be challenging audiences when you're dealing with a piece that is quite intimate. And like Maria Stuart, it's quite a demanding piece on the audience. And it ended up being a really electric atmosphere in the theater. And I think particularly his last line that he was actually moved by the performance, that's something you don't often see a critic either admitting to or highlighting. And I think the fact that he chose to do that very consciously, it means that the piece was more about than just good singing or an interesting production. There's actually what you hope happens in the theater actually occurred. There was kind of a transcendence that happened. And that I'm very happy to publicize and put out there for people because I want them to come ready to have an experience. But you do point out it can be tricky that, okay, so now the audience is going to be expecting this and I had better deliver. And I think what I've learned over my years in the career is that anytime you try and play for an effect, you're going to fail. So what I really concentrate on doing is putting myself at the beginning of the night, actually even in the days beforehand when I'm preparing mentally and just getting in the zone for the performance, is I have to simply go in there and do the work that got me to that opening night, do the work that I went through in the rehearsal and not play into the idea of expectation. That's really deadly as an artist. I'm most successful when I go out there, I've lined up my vocalizing and my emotional work and my prep work, and I just go out there and I do the work. And what happens, happens. I can't ever control the audience reaction.
So in other words, to have great art, you need to have great craft to begin with.
Yes.
This role in particular, you refer to it being a very intimate role. And it's an odd thing that with these HD broadcasts, they in fact become, if anything, probably more intimate for the audience, not in the actual hall itself, because they're getting the benefit of close-ups, they're getting surround sound, they're getting all of these things that are very much more microscopic than the audience in the hall is getting unless they're sitting in the front row.
Yes.
Does that change your approach?
No, not at all. I received wonderful advice from Leonard Folia, wonderful director. I worked with him on Dead Man Walking. And we were working in Houston and we had this amazing experience in the rehearsal room, and it was some of the best work I've ever done as a part of an ensemble cast. And we went to the stage, and the Wortham Center there in Houston is huge. And I looked at him, I pulled him aside, I said, Lenny, I said, don't let me start playing to the theater, meaning sort of getting bigger.
The back row, right.
Yeah. I mean, I always do that anyway, but what we were finding was such a really concentrated piece. I didn't want to then leave the stage and go to the theater, which that can be deadly as a performer. And he looked at me and he said, you know, Joyce, he said, there's only two things that exist on the stage, true and false. And true can be really big and it can be really small and it will read. False can be really big and really small and it will read. And I have always kept that in my mind since I heard that, because if a performance is extremely focused, even in the size of the Met, the smallest gesture or impulse will read. If it's true, it will carry everything that it needs to. But false can also read in either way. So whether I'm playing just for the theater or whether there's a camera, you know, 5 inches from my nose, if I'm embedded in the truth of that moment and the truth of that character, it will work for camera or for the last row of the theater. I'm certain of that.
The role itself, typically, I was going to say there are two schools of thought on this, but let's say that there are, in a lot of instances, musicians, and I'm talking about both instrumentalists, conductors, and singers, who will say to you that everything you need to know about the role or about the piece is on the page. And there are others who will say, no, I want to know the historical context of how and when the music was written. I want to know the circumstances under which the composer was living. And if it's in the case of opera, which, you know, many operas are based on actual historic events, I want to know as much historical truth about the character that I will be playing. Which area are you in? Are you in Donizetti wrote this, it's his version of history, or do you want to know more about Mary Stuart?
I'm in the middle, because I think especially... I've done a few historic characters, Sister Helen Prejean in Dead Man Walking, Mary Stuart now. I think it's really very important for me, especially as a modern interpreter of this. You know, very little gets past an audience, especially, you know, HD cameras. I need to know the historical context of these pieces, and I need to know why Donizetti chose to make Mary a bit more sympathetic than she actually, I think, was, according to history. He was playing...
Tell that to the Scots, though.
Oh, no, come on, I love Mary, of course. But you know, she was a complicated figure. And in the Donizetti, she's a little more watered down. But Donizetti was playing to a Catholic audience, you know, and I think that's important because... It's important to understand why the idea of martyrdom is played up in confession. I mean, the confession of this opera, for me, is the heartbeat. A lot of people say it's the confrontation scene with Elizabeth. It's, for me, it's the confession. And everything then pivots around that. This is really important, knowing that it was a Catholic audience, it was a Catholic composer, it was for this kind of genre. I think to flesh out Mary and make her less of a sort of caricature, it's very important to know the historical context. You know, she suffered terribly from rheumatoid arthritis. She was shocking to people when they saw her go to her death because she used to be so tall and athletic and lithe and healthy, and they saw this shell of a woman, you know, 18 years past, in, you know, locked in confinement, very little sunshine, damp, cold confines. She couldn't even write letters at the end. You know, it's, everything had been taken away from her. And she was shocking to people. That's not indicated anywhere in Donizetti's score, but we're choosing to really highlight how diminished and frail she was at the end in a visual way. So that's something that is not anti-Donizetti, but it's informed by the historical research of her. But at the end of the day, I am playing Donizetti's Mary. I cannot impose things that don't exist on there, but I can inform my performance from a historic perspective.
And how much of that then is to do with what the director wants, what the stage directions are?
Well, it's a lot. You know, both Elsa and I, Elsa who's playing Elizabeth, both of us came with a having done a lot of research and having come with a lot of ideas of our own. And Sir David McVicar took these and brought his own ideas to the mix, and then we sort of shake it and stir it, and we end up with a really collaborative finished product. Well, it's not even finished. It's changing all the time. Every performance is different. But, you know, he took what we were bringing to the table, and then I took some suggestions from him. I didn't expect to play the age quite so much, and yet he really wanted that. So I thought, great, let's go for it.
Can I take you back a little bit, because we are in Philadelphia, and take you a little bit to your time here? I heard an interview you did for the BBC with Norman LeBrecht couple of years ago, and you said that your time at the AVA was not when you really blossomed. It was not the most beneficial time in your life, that you probably started to blossom when you went to Houston. Is that right?
Well, I won't say it wasn't a beneficial time. In retrospect, it was probably one of the most beneficial periods, because I was not blossoming in Philadelphia. It was not my time yet. And I had a lot of technical work that I was still I still needed to address. And also, I will say, too, personally, I had to figure out a little bit more about who I was and why I really wanted to sing. And all of those things came to the forefront at AVA, because it wasn't an easy time for me. I wasn't sort of a star singer there. And it was a point where, because people weren't designating me a star and it wasn't clear that I would go on and have a career, I had to go deep inside myself and say, do I still want to stay with this? Do I still think I have something inside of me? And that's why, in essence, it was probably the most beneficial time in terms of me really going deep inside and saying, yes, I want to stick with this.
Why did you want to stick with it?
I had to.
Ah, yes, but that's like, you know, you hear this a lot about writers. You know, the really successful writers are the ones who need to do it every day. And to an extent, it may be true in all art forms that there are those who are not, you know, they are singers. That's not what they do. That's what they are. But there are a lot of people who aren't any good at it. I mean, there are people who are singers who are just never going to have a career at it.
Right.
Were you going to stick with it and see how far it would go? Or did you have the confidence that you had something?
Oh, confidence is a big word at that period. I had the suspicion, maybe, or that sort of nagging inner voice. I was not confident yet at all, but I had that nagging thing of like, I know nobody can see this yet, but I think I've got it. I think it's in me. And I gave myself permission to try it as long as I could. And thankfully, success started coming before I gave up. But barely, because even my time in Houston wasn't particularly easy either. I wasn't a designated star in Houston either, but things started coming to me. But at the same time, there in Philadelphia, I was absorbing everything that I could. And I prepare a role like Maria. The work that I observed Christopher Makatsouris doing there at AVA on recitatives and how to really, that so much of the singing came from the text and the color of the text and the emotion of the text, that is still with me today. That made such a huge impact and imprint on me. So even if I wasn't thriving at AVA, the education that I got there today is absolutely part of the reason I'm successful. And I think it's part of the reason I'm the kind of artist that I am, text-driven, character-driven, expression-driven. It's not just about vocalizing.
But that said, and I don't want to blow smoke, but you have a very beautiful instrument. Was it always this thing of beauty? Was it, when you were beginning, something that was just so lovely to I mean, you don't hear yourself the way other people hear you, but take my word for it, you have a very, very beautiful voice.
Thank you. I'll take that.
Was that always the case?
No, it wasn't. I was, I think, first of all, known as being sort of a stage animal, confident on stage, and a good musician. But the voice was not pretty. And I think that's one of the reasons I didn't technically know what I was doing yet. I didn't have freedom of the breath. And so therefore, the voice was always a little bit under pressure and a little bit harsh. And so there's a reason I wasn't terribly successful in those early years. And it was the vocal technical work that I started doing in Houston that the voice started getting free. And I started really finding my voice, just from a vocal aspect. And that needed to happen. that absolutely needed to happen. And happily it did. And I continuously work to find more freedom in the voice.
And did you know what that had happened, or did people around you tell you there's something different about you now these days? This last 6 months, you sound different. I mean, was there an aha moment?
It was a slow burn for me, because it was a 3-year process between 26 and 28. It was 3 years of study with my teacher in Houston where things finally started clicking. The aha, long aha moment for me was when I could start doing the musical things that I heard in my head or that I wanted to do. And all of a sudden, I had the technical ability and control to do that. You know, I could diminuendo a note. I could sing through my passaggio. I could sustain a high note. I was like, oh my God, I think I'm getting this. And then the outside feedback was work, was contracts. And doing well in competitions finally. And so it wasn't that people were like, oh my God, you have a beautiful voice. Here's a job. I thought, I'll take that. That's confirmation enough for me.
And now going forward, because clearly any artist wants to, you know, get up every day and make better of themselves than they did the previous day. What are the things that are happening to you as a result of your own, you know, growing older, not that you're old, but just living? And how much do you think you're changing because of the volume of work that you're doing these days?
God, that's it's a big question. I've always said that the theater and music has been my best teacher in life. I am such a student of the theater because things like living in the moment in particular, if you're not in the moment on the stage, you're completely lost. You have no hope. And I've tried to really take that in my life. And I'm actually feeling that in a big way in this last year with the Drama Queens tour, the recording, which has been a big success in a lot of ways for me. And then this role of Maria Stuarda, I trust myself in a deeper way than I ever have. I've always had confidence on stage, not always as a singer, but on stage. But I always sort of erred on the side of doing things on stage. And I think now I have a level of trust that I don't have to do a lot. I can just really get in there, sing the words, be merry, and that's going to be enough. And I think with a role like this, that's, you know, I'm glad I didn't sing her 5 years ago. I'm glad I'm singing her now, because I think the time is right. As a musician, as a vocalist, and as a performer, everything's coming together in the right time for me.
But do you think then that, I don't know, having your heart broken, having personal loss, I don't know, all the things that happen to a person in a life, I mean, do you take them on board? Clearly they become part of you, but are they private things? Are they personal things that really, you know, they don't, it's none of the audience's business. What, I don't need to use those things to be an artist.
I use everything.
Right.
I don't know that I'm one of those people that says you have to suffer to be a real artist. I have suffered. I've suffered deeply in my life. But I am a real advocate for happiness.
Forgetting going on. Lest we forget the wheelchair incident. You know, when somebody gets up and gets on with it.
There is that. That's, yeah, absolutely. Life is short. But that suffering and the difficulties in my life absolutely inform who I am as a person. I'm just selfish. I much prefer to be happy, so I really try to cultivate that in my life. But absolutely, the pain that I've gone through in various ways, that, you know, it always comes out of nowhere, sort of socks you over the head. Of course, I use that. That informs me as a human being, and therefore it informs me as an artist. But I don't feel the need to cultivate that and stay in that place. I'll go through it. I'll learn from it. I'll use it. I'll use it on the stage. But in my life, I prefer to be on the other side of the equation.
But for instance, okay, I mean, I know a little bit about rheumatoid arthritis. It runs in my family. And it's been told to me by my mother and my grandmother, it's like having broken bones. Mm. You've had broken bones.
Yeah.
So for instance, in trying to get inside this woman who is broken down both by events in her life and this horrible degenerative illness that she has, did you say, I remember about the pain of a broken bone, or was, does that, is that, am I completely off course here?
No, I didn't actually think about broken bones, but that's a wonderful image to have about, because I don't have arthritis. So thank you for that. I'll use that on the next show. But it is, it's knowing what that, I think my main thing, because it's hard to show rheumatoid arthritis on the stage. I'm going for more of a frailty. And I've sort of developed sort of a shake with her. I mean, so did she have Parkinson's? People are asking me. It's like, no, she didn't have Parkinson's, but that's a visible way that I can communicate how frail she was and how, because, you know, I run onto the stage in the first act and I make very quick gestures and hopefully look very graceful at the beginning. And I wanted to juxtapose that in the second act by showing this frailty. But having suffered physical pain, and, you know, I have my own difficulty sometimes walking anyway, I use that in her as well. Yeah, I use everything at my disposal, everything that I know I put into these characters.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.